if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest will be the film critic Philip French. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly. I'm here to guide you through our programmes on Radio 3 this afternoon, which continue in just a moment with the music of a man who led a colourful life, to say the least, the Renaissance composer Carlo Gesualdo. He produced a great quantity of rather remarkable music during his lifetime, but it was a life dogged with troubles. He was accused of a double murder, of witchcraft, and masochism, amongst other things. He was actually a prince, the Prince of Venosa, and led, it seems, a somewhat isolated life. I wonder why. Find out for sure in the Early Music Show in a couple of minutes' time here on Radio 3. That's after a look at the BBC News this lunchtime. The head of the Unite Union, Len McCluskey, says he's delighted the organisation was cleared of any wrongdoing in the selection of a Labour candidate in the constituency of Falkirk. Labour began an investigation after claims the union had tried to rig the process. The row prompted the Labour leader Ed Miliband to propose changes to his party's relationship with the unions by giving union members a choice of whether to pay money to Labour rather than fees being automatically transferred. Mr Miliband insists he'll press ahead with the reforms. A prominent Liberal Democrat MP says she'll stand down at the next election because she's dismayed by some of the policies Nick Clegg has backed in government. Sarah Tether singled out her party's approach to immigration and welfare for criticism. The Liberal Democrats said they were disappointed with her decision. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has said the government is not gung-ho about military action, but that the world needs to respond to the use of chemical weapons in Syria. Mr. Hague said there were no plans to ask Parliament to vote again on the matter, but added that if circumstances changed dramatically, everyone would look at things differently. Officials in Afghanistan say a NATO airstrike in the east of the country has killed 15 people, including 9 civilians. NATO said 10 militants died in the strike, but it had no reports of any civilian deaths. The government has insisted that money is being pumped into hospital and emergency departments in England after a BBC survey found evidence of staff shortages. Labour has called on ministers to get a grip urgently on the situation. The International Olympic Committee, having chosen Tokyo as the host of the 2020 Games, will decide today which new sports will be admitted to the event. Under consideration are wrestling, squash, and a joint bid from baseball and softball. And the weather, there'll be scattered showers in western parts this afternoon. Some of them will be heavy and thundery. It'll be mostly dry and sunny in eastern areas, but it will cloud over later this afternoon. Well, that's the BBC News at 3 minutes past one. Verez and Berio feature in our Sunday concert in an hour from now. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra will be conducted by Ilan Volkov in two 20th century masterworks in that concert, which they gave at the Usher Hall in Edinburgh as part of this year's International Festival. Hear what they are at 2 o'clock. And I'll be featuring that, following that rather, with a rather wonderful recording which has recently been released as part of a mammoth boxed set of the pianist Leon Fleischer. His classic 1961 recording with the Cleveland Orchestra under George Sell playing Beethoven's Fifth Piano Concerto, The Emperor. It's a remarkable recording, really quite something if you've never heard it. A dream team, really, in that Sell, being undoubtedly one of the greatest conductors of the 20th century, found in Fleischer a perfect collaborator. So if you can be here for that at around 3:15, I promise you it'll be well worth it. Next this afternoon, though, a programme that's certainly worth listening to. It's The Early Music Show, and it's presented today by Catherine Bott.
Hello. Over the last 10 years on the Early Music Show, we've featured a lot of composers about whose long-ago lives very little is known. But some musicians are well-documented, and others have a sort of infamy thrust upon them. Take the subject of today's programme, who died exactly 400 years ago on the 8th of September 1613. Carlo Gesualdo seems to be remembered more for his depravity than his music. Mind you, the tortured harmonies of some of his madrigals really fuel the myth.
Thank you.
I die languishing of grief, Moro Lasso, from Gesualdo's sixth book of madrigals, performed by Il Complesso Barocco, directed by Alan Curtis. This is music that reaches out and grips your vitals, and it would work very well as the soundtrack to one of those historical dramas that are keeping people glued to their televisions at the moment. We've had the Tudors and the last of the Plantagenets. How about the Gesualdos? To learn more about the skilled, dedicated musician behind the Gesualdo myth, today I'm delighted to be talking down the line to Glenn Watkins, who is Earl V. Moore Professor Emeritus of Music History and Musicology at the University of Michigan in the United States. His recent book, The Gesualdo Hex, is an eloquent corrective to the sensationalist school of research. Let's get this out of the way right at the start. This question of the bloody murder of Gesualdo's wife and her lover in their bed. What is the myth? What did he do?
Well, the murder is not a myth. He actually did commit the murder. The question is that he was not some sort of madman, but rather the opposite. There was a social code at the time that virtually demanded that any person of his station, and he was a prince, after all, and one of the wealthiest men in all of Campania, it was virtually required of him, once adultery was spotted and known, that he is obliged to murder his wife and the lover. He was not the only one. Somehow or other, the view comes across as though this was not what one would normally run across. But one doesn't have to read very far, and one can come with a list of about, maybe five or six composers, even, the time who committed murder of their wives or various people, according to various social codes. And I think that's all we have to say here. There was a social code, and it had to do with honor and all of that. That does not make him a madman, but maybe from our current perspectives, it does seem a little bit off the norm.
I guess you could say that whatever the social codes he was obeying, it still doesn't really make it all right to kill your wife and her lover, even if you are severely provoked. But it's not the most interesting thing about Carlo Gesualdo, is it?
No, it's not. Anybody who comes to know Gesualdo is not all of this business about his personal life. The thing that we really want to know about the man named Don Carlo Gesualdo is his music, of course. Not just that he was a composer, but was one of those extraordinary composers, not only of his age, but I would submit of all time.
Well, it's very hard to separate the tortured harmonies and eroticism of some of his madrigals from this modern revisionist post-Freudian analysis of his life. He was a sadistic killer, or not, possibly, a depressive, a masochist. Your book makes it very clear that that's not appropriate to apply modern psychoanalysis to Gesualdo's life and character. But the music does reinforce it, doesn't it, a bit?
Well, it does, but it's not only his madrigals. I mean, take a look at the madrigal text of virtually anybody in the late 16th century, and you will see many of the same themes, just not only repetitive, but almost obsessive on the questions of life, death, intimately intertwined with the notion of love. But he was always looking around for these epigrammatic, very brief texts packed with this overabundance of imagery, which for the most part seemed to be not only dour or sad, but melancholy. And there's the key word. The whole notion of melancholy is a Renaissance attitude for all artists. It was very much the standard, the norm for the day to impact the musical language with such texts.
Oh,
the Hilliard Ensemble with an oxymoronic concept set to music in a madrigal from Gesualdo's fifth book, O Dolorosa Gioia, O Grievous Joy, O Sweetest Pain. My guest on the programme today, down the line from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Professor Glenn Watkins, author of The Gesualdo Hex, Music, Myth and Memory. Glenn, sticking with the old Gesualdo myth for a moment longer, where does his involvement with witchcraft fit in?
Well, it took place in Gesualdo, in the village, which today is no larger than 5,000 population. It's the town where his castle was. And there he was in isolation in this fairly rural setting, and had his own little academy there with enough singers, enough musicians to make life palatable. But this witchcraft thing started, and there was actually not only one witch, but a couple of witches there that were performing their magic. And you see, here we are talking over the BBC about an issue that if I were to tell the whole story, it would be, I think, very unsavory. Namely, what was involved in the witchcraft had to do with the transfer of bodily fluids. What was going on there, it was actually extraordinary. And I say that with a capital E, extraordinary, to our eyes, ears, what have you. And needless to say, it then went to trial. And he was ultimately exonerated, and the witches were held to be witches, and they were put into prison. Put into prison where? Actually right in the castle where Gesualdo lived. Very strange thing. So in other words, one hardly knows how to sort out all the details that were going on. But from this time on, Gesualdo wrote only sacred music, and he obviously looked back on his whole life, of beginning with the murder of his first wife and now this involvement in all this witchcraft. And I think, well, shall we say, looking for personal salvation. And this particular piece, Ave Dulcissima Maria, which I think is one of the most beautiful ones from the first book of motets, is an extraordinarily sublime piece. It doesn't seem to be full of all the torture and the personal anguish that we find in the madrigals, but we find a kind of sweetness there. Ave Dulcissima Maria, hail the most sweet and beautiful Holy Mary. One finds a turn to a sense of communion, if you will, that seems to be light years away from the madrigals.
Thank you.
Gesualdo's Marian motet, Ave Dulcissima Maria, sung by the Tallis Scholars, directed by Peter Phillips. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott. This programme is also available as a download. I'm talking to Glenn Watkins, an authority on Gesualdo. Glenn, the next music we're going to hear is from his Tenebrae Responsories for Holy Saturday. For whom did he write this music?
I think he wrote it for himself, but obviously it was meant to be performed in his private chapel, which he had built in the 1590s, the Santa Maria della Grazia, there in Gesualdo, where in 1609 he had had a portrait commissioned, a beautiful portrait, I must say, which has been now restored and put in its appropriate gold frame and placed at the altar in the church. And it shows the Gesualdo the Penitent kneeling in the left-hand corner. And by his side is Carlo Borromeo, who was to be made a saint in 1610 with his right hand on Gesualdo's right shoulder, so to say, you have my blessing, dear nephew.
Well, hearing about this work of art in the chapel, I'm afraid I'm reminded rather vulgarly of Batman and Robin, and I'm tempted to say holy wishful thinking. Because he really wanted Uncle Borromeo's approval and, of course, divine approval, and he's painting it into his life, isn't he?
He absolutely is. And to get back to the Tenebrae services, obviously, Tenebrae services were not music to be sung throughout the year. It was to be sung on three specific days at one specific time, namely in Holy Week, the 3 days prior to Easter, 9 responses for each day. So if you wrote the complete set for the 3 days, you had a total of 27. There had been very few composers who had ever set all 27 before. He didn't write just some music for Holy Week. He wrote the complete set of 27 responses, which was an extraordinary thing. But he doesn't write Easter music. He writes it for the 3 days prior to Easter. But there are texts at the end, one in particular, Estimatus Sum, which it says he goes down into the pits, but then he is free amongst the dead, inter mortuos liber, amongst the dead, free. And on the word liber, free, he removes himself from the lower cavernous voices and the deepest registers and goes to the highest point that the tenor sings in the entire cycle. All I can say is amongst the dead, free, that's very interesting. It sounds like Easter looms, and indeed it was text for Holy Saturday. So Gesualdo sets up Easter, but he does not celebrate Easter. He prepares for it. And it seems to me like he was preparing his soul for this final release and resurrection himself. Thank you.
Two pieces of music for Tenebrae by Gesualdo, Andrew Parrott directing the Taverner Consort, and before that, the ensemble Tenebrae, directed by Nigel Short. It was said, Glenn Watkins, of Gesualdo in his last years, he was only 47 when he died, that he was lost in music. And it's obvious from listening to his music, he was highly technically skilled. But how original is his music, do you think? What were his influences?
Well, the influence is somewhat theoretical. It all happened because of one factor. Namely, having murdered his first wife, he goes north to Ferrara to find a second wife. There at Ferrara, he is in the court of the Este family, which is the musically richest musical court in all of Italy at the time, famous for their singing ladies, were so famous that popes and queens and kings from the courts of Europe would come to hear them sing. They were extraordinary, a group, obviously, and Luzzaschi, one of the most renowned composers in the court of the Estes at the time, wrote specifically for the three ladies and had published some pieces for them to make use of their virtuosic skills. Gesualdo said that when he went north, one of the people he wanted to meet most of all was this fellow by the name of Luzzasco Luzzaschi. Luzzaschi was not an inveterate chromaticist. He wrote two or three pieces that were rather extremely chromatic, but this was not his style. He wrote many, many books of madrigals, and his style is not the style of a Gesualdo madrigal, but he did write a few specimens. And when Gesualdo went north to the Este to take a second wife, he came into not only into his presence, but challenged him. How do you challenge him? Well, you say, here's the text, let's both set it. And you set it and I'll set it, and then we'll have a listen to both of them and see what you think. And it's very interesting because there are at least three texts there that were set at the same time by these two composers. And Luzzaschi steps forward in one of them, I Tieni Miei Querelle, in one of his best chromatic modes, as though to say, well, yes, I can do it. But Gesualdo's is more fractured. It's more word-dependent. He's more immersed in the text. But Ferrara was a capital of chromaticism, not just because of Luzzaschi, but because of the publication of a treatise by a gentleman by the name of Vicentino, a book called Musica Antiqua Ridotto alla Moderna Pratica, Ancient Music Reduced for Modern Practice. And there they went into the Greek modes, very much in the Renaissance style of reviving the classics, the Greek classics, right? Well, we didn't have any Greek music, but we did have some Greek music theory. And there it was sufficient evidence that the Greeks talked about three different genera. The diatonic, the chromatic, and the enharmonic. The enharmonic even got into quarter tone, let's call it that. This fellow Vicentino actually wrote some pieces that made use of these kinds of quarter tones. And let me just wrap it all up by saying that chromaticism was a topic for investigation from a theoretical standpoint from the 1550s on, where in Ferrara, precisely the place where Gesualdo went to take a second wife. It was there that he was exposed to all this.
Douce Memoire, directed by Denis Raison, with Vicentino's Laura che il verde lauro, a song about a sighing breeze, but with words by Petrarch, those mentions of Laura and lauro have an extra dimension. The breeze sighs for his beloved Laura. And before that, we heard La Veneziana with Luzzaschi's Itene mie querele. Rise my complaints and fly to her who is the source of my eternal woe. Glenn, from our conversation, I am getting a portrait of a very conflicted man. He's a prince. He's a talented man and he knows it. He's proprietorial about his creative achievement. At the same time, he was debauched, psychologically complex. Maybe he's what we'd now call bipolar, but then melancholy was more than a fashion. It was of philosophical significance in the turbulent century in which he lived. Apparently, it was said of him, he was afflicted by a vast horde of demons. When you listen to the music of Gesualdo, with all the authority of your knowledge about him, do you find it possible to listen to the music in the abstract, or do all these things about his life and character inform your listening?
I think it would be false for me to say absolutely not, but I would say that when I listen to the music, I really don't think about that. On the other hand, I've been so informed about issues of his private life that it's obviously embedded in my mind, and I can't really just turn it off completely. But I really do listen to it as music, simply because as music is extraordinary. Susan McClary, who's one of America's greatest musicologists, wrote a book on modal theory. And she said a very surprising thing, I think, for most people, and it's absolutely true. That is to say, some people like to think that he wrote this sort of crazy music, but that he was no technician. To which Susan McClary said, Gesualdo had to have control of enormous quantities of technique in order to bring this off. This isn't something that he stumbles across some sort of weird harmonies and puts them down and they retain their shock value to this day. If one knows anything about composing music at the time, one sees that there's an extraordinary craftsman there. Let's begin with this craft, and it's there, and it's solid. And there is the miracle. He is a craftsman as well as a person who has a wonderful ear and perhaps has, as you put it, bipolar inclinations, whatever that might be with respect to the emotional aspect of the music.
Thank you.
From Gesualdo's second book of sacred songs, that was O Anima Sanctissima, a prayer for intercession to the Holy Spirit, performed by Vocal Consort Berlin, directed by James Wood. Gesualdo died on the 8th of September 1613. Was there a school of Gesualdo? What was his legacy?
There was not a school. On the other hand, he was recognized by a person of the stature of Claudio Monteverdi, but he did not leave a school of composers that went on writing music like he did. Not at all. One can find specimens here and there. Sigismondo d'India, he was from Palermo, Sicily, but had come north to Italy early in his life. He wrote some madrigals on the very text that Gesualdo had set and showed that he was very knowledgeable about the madrigals of Gesualdo and gave his own interpretations. But there are examples here and there. They're certainly far too few in number to be called a school.
La Veneziana singing Sigismondo d'India's Donna quanto più addentro, Lady, the more I know of your heart, the less I understand you. Gesualdo, murderer, genius, bit of both. That's quite a decision for everyone to take. My thanks to Glenn Watkins for a really enlightening and lively conversation. Gesualdo's life is indeed fascinating. His music, even more so. Read Glenn Watkin's book, The Gesualdo Hex, and enjoy The Man and His Music. Let's end with a final madrigal.
Gesualdo's madrigal Belta Poiché Tassenti, Concerto Italiano, was directed there by Rinaldo Alessandrini. And that ends today's Early Music Show, which was presented by Catherine Bott. She was in conversation with Glenn Watkins, and the programme was produced by Sam Phillips.
The last night of the BBC proms. The very first note to the very last encore. All online. To listen again to the last night of the proms or any other BBC proms concert from the last 7 days, go to bbc.co.uk/proms.
Yes, a wonderful impromptu improvisations on a set of gypsy songs by Nigel Kennedy last night, if you missed them. Well worth seeing again along with the rest of the concert as well on the Radio 3 website. You can watch as well as listen to the images for the next 7 days. Well, the proms have not been the only summer music festival that we've been covering here on Radio 3 in the UK. It's time now to join the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra for the Sunday concert today. And this was given during this year's Edinburgh International Festival. It's presented by Marianne Kennedy.
Two giants of 20th century music are at the heart of this afternoon's Sunday concert, given by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra during the opening weekend of this year's Edinburgh International Festival. The second half of the concert will be given over to Luciano Berio's Sinfonia, but we start with Edgar Varèse and his Integrale, a work that was the culmination of a trio of compositions building on the earlier ideas of hyperprism and octandre, but it was scored for a much larger ensemble, 11 wind instruments and a large percussion section, 17 instruments performed by a quartet of players. Varèse himself wrote about Integrale for the first performance, warning against trying to rationalise any kind of meaning in or analysis of the music, and encouraging the audience to encounter the music for itself. But the first audience was quick to make associations just the same, with the likes of painter Georgia O'Keeffe likening it to Broadway at night. Integrale is in three sections, the first processing from an opening clarinet theme and the second heralded by a great brass fanfare. The third section begins quietly with woodwind solos before a return to the chorale-like theme of the middle of the work. The brass, wind and percussion of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra took to the stage of the Usher Hall, directed by their principal guest conductor, Ilan Volkov, for this performance of Edgar Varèse's Integrale.
Thank you.
The BBC's Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Ilan Volkov in that performance of Edgar Varèse's Integral from their concert recorded at the opening weekend of this year's Edinburgh International Festival. The next work in this concert, Varèse's Amérique, is pretty much the earliest surviving work of his, as all the music that he'd written in Germany before World War I was destroyed in a warehouse fire in Berlin. Amérique is very much then a fresh start for the composer, written during the early years of his move to the States and inspired by what he called the River Symphony of New York's Hudson River, complete with foghorns and whistles. He was writing, he said, while still under the spell of a new world and its childhood associations of adventure and possibility. Amérique is more a concept than a geographical depiction, and we can hear many of the sights and sounds that surrounded Varèse in his new home: jazz, skyscrapers, river traffic, and the general hubbub of the city. And while he declared himself very happy with the work to begin with, what we're going to hear is the revised score from 1927, which saw some quite significant changes to the original. A slightly smaller orchestration, for instance, although it's still...